then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 27th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, let's start off this week with some response from last week's segment about the kid in California, Noah, who wrote in asking my advice on whether or not to go into the Imperial military, or else just jump in his truck and head up here to Seattle with nothing but the t-shirt on his back and $100 in his pocket. Now, this is from a comrade named George, don't know where he's at, but he wrote in to say as follows, and some of you other young men, and God forbid young women out there, may want to listen up to what he has to say. Dear HAC, as much as I hate to say it, I have experience with Obama's progressive military, and I was in Noah's situation less than a year ago, so here it goes. If you must join the military, do not join the Army. HAC hit it spot on in RFN episode for March 20th, 2014. The Army has been negrified, meaning you will be surrounded by the worst of the worst. To enlist in any of the armed services, you are required to take an aptitude test of sorts. The Air Force and the Navy require a score of 50 out of 100 on that test for a candidate to even be considered for enlistment. The Army requires a score of 14. Now, that being said, HAC once again is right. Join the Air Force if you can. I can tell you from experience that Air Force installations are safer, cleaner, and get more government money for base upkeep, which basically means new housing for airmen. Like everything else with our government, the Air Force is succumbing to the cancer that is political correctness. However, you are more likely to get something out of the Air Force than you are with any other branch as far as obtaining a skill goes. So if you're going to have to put up with the PC bullcrap anyway, then make the most out of your time in the service. I did go the Air Force route because it was the best road for me to take straight out of high school. But this isn't about me, it's about you. Make damn sure that the military is your best option before you commit to it, because once you do, you are Obama's property for 4 years. Signed, George. Okay, now this is a reply from the young man, Noah himself. Thank you for the reply, HAC. I'm especially grateful that you gave me a shout-out, so to speak, on the latest RFN podcast for the 20th of March. Now, I have made the decision not to join the military of Zog, and so I went with the next best thing for any lower-income young white male like myself, who was just about to graduate from high school. I signed up for the Job Corps. I signed up for a year of work where I will gain much work experience and afterwards have scholarships open for me in things such as auto mechanics, for example. I'm going to be called out this summer, and my recruiter told me I'm going to be extremely busy this summer with all of the forest fires, thanks to the massive droughts that are common down here. So you see, HAC, at least some young white males are actually listening to you on the whole getting a marketable job skill thing. Well, I'm glad to hear that, Noah. Yes, I know that joining the Job Corps will be a largely miserable year, but my relationship with my family has become so irreconcilable that both of us have come to the consensus that it would be better for all of us if I left the house. My plan is simple. Work in the Corps for a year doing backbreaking labor for shitty pay but good training. After this year, buy my new truck and come home to the Northwest. I look forward to meeting y'all next summer. Thank you for your business and time. Sincerely, Noah. Okay, well, keep us posted, will you, Noah?
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today I'm doing talk number 2 in my series on real politics as they relate to new or underdeveloped white nationalists. And just so we're clear, I can't fault someone for not having redeveloped their politics to match their racist beliefs, since there's an awful lot to consider. In general, American society doesn't do much in the way of directing people towards true information, and for obvious reasons. As a reminder, I'm doing this series of talks because many of the points the party tries to convey end up going over people's heads. I have a genuinely hard time relating to that because, as I said before, most, but by no means all, of my general political education happened before finding the party. As a result, I tend to react to most things the party says as if they're correct and immediately obvious. Other people might not be at that point yet, and we must make room for them. I recall I had to relearn a few subjects after going full-on racial, both before and after finding the party. I'm doing what I can to rehash certain concepts with a racial perspective. Most of us, on our way to racial understanding, go through political scene after political scene and end up with a somewhat warped view of the world before first going racist. Because of this warped view, many of us tend towards politics which, while vaguely racist, aren't actually racially healthy or even very wise. Most of this is due to enthusiasm at finally figuring the world out, and that's a good thing. The trouble is that most of us don't seem to rethink previously held positions very well. So today I'm going to cover human nature as it pertains to white nationalism. This isn't going to be one of those overly positive items like I've begrudgingly done before. This topic is somewhat unsettling because every single one of us, me included, is going to encounter some part of ourselves we dislike and would rather not acknowledge lest we be compelled to do something about it. However, new nationalists as well as old need to understand what they're up against when they deal with other people. Before I really get started, I'm going to have to introduce the stages of learning. I understand this might be a little too academic and dry for some listeners, but you're all politely asked to bear with me, since I'd like to see if I can't make some of you reconsider exactly how well you understand subjects related to racial politics. There are, at a very high level, 4 stages of learning. A person can be at a different stage on each subject they're familiar with, though we're all on stage 1 concerning every other subject. Stage 1 is unconscious incompetence. In other words, you don't know what you don't know. While that seems obvious, a person can be so ignorant that they actually believe they have mastery of a subject while truly being utterly wrong. Stage 2 is conscious incompetence. This, while not a great state to be in, at least means a person is aware they don't know something. You'll note that we've moved from unconscious to conscious activity. This transition signals that the person in question has taken it upon themselves to confront reality and admit ignorance. More than anything else, this is what makes learning possible and is sometimes, but not always, where someone seemingly well-versed in a matter ends up after discovering new information, as they were unconsciously incompetent prior to said discovery. Stage 3 is conscious competence. Here, someone knows enough about a subject or skill to use it well, but not quite proficiently. Some minor mistakes or misunderstandings may still exist, but not many. Lastly, stage 4 is unconscious competence. When a person is unconsciously competent in a skill or field of knowledge, they use it proficiently and with nearly zero effort. Mistakes are almost never made because they are not actively controlling the process of exercising their skill or knowledge. They merely dictate the result they wish to achieve and are able to accomplish it without friction. As dry as this may seem, relearning subjects can be hard, and it's best to understand that new or underdeveloped racists can get stuck in their learning process through no fault of their own. If you're only going to get one thing out of my talk today, make it the stages of learning. If you're going to get 2 things, make them the stages of learning and the following observation. Human nature is such that facts do not matter. At first, this sounds like stubbornness, but it's something more significant than mere denial. I had the strange experience of coming to realize this during my last year in high school. I had been assigned the task of writing a position paper on a political subject, which I won't mention here since doing so would start an argument we want to avoid. I did a proper job on it, and the lefty teacher didn't like what I had to say, so I got a lesser grade. Other students were curious as to what the teacher didn't like, so they read my paper. Afterward, they discussed it with me. While they agreed I did a great job on the paper and proved my point conclusively, they didn't like the conclusion I came to and were going to ignore the facts I exposed them to. Later in the same school year, I had cause to write a letter to the editor of the school newspaper in response to something incredibly lefty they ran in a prior issue. As a result, I wasn't too popular. A response was submitted and published. Other students made it a point to let me know they liked the response to my material rather than my submission. I made a polite effort to inform them the respondents were lying and that this was trivial for me to prove. They agreed off the cuff, but only because they knew so before speaking with me. The facts involved didn't faze them one bit. If this sounds absurd, it is. Absurd or not, this is how people are. Before I learned to overcome this tendency in myself, I was a dyed-in-the-wool Zionist Republican patriotard. I know whereof I speak, and if we're all honest with ourselves, each of us has struggled with this in the past. This isn't just teenagers, either. Most adults act this way on a daily basis. I won't keep up on this single point much longer, but I must at least drive it home. I've spoken about waking people up before, but for today, I'll leave the snark out of it since I really would appreciate some serious consideration on a deeper matter. The whole reason I've been so adamant that we not focus on waking people up is because it doesn't matter how much proof you shake in front of someone's face when they don't care about it to begin with. When someone makes the choice to accept their racism, then they only need to be handed a reading list. They're going to be hungry to relearn everything and will do so provided they're given a direction. If some among us are having trouble acknowledging this aspect of human nature, it's because of, well, this aspect of human nature. All right, that's a bit circular of me, but it's also tautological. The question is why someone would fall back on ignoring something which is so easily observed. And with that, we're on to the next point I have to make. Human nature is also such that we expect other people to do the things we're not willing to. In reality, other people aren't the solution to your problems. This doesn't sound so bad, but it frequently goes so far that it morphs into a sense of entitlement to the finished product of the effort being refused. Case in point, those who refuse to come home even though they're fully able. When I started coming up with this material, I wasn't aware Mr. Covington would bring up the same subject a week or two before this talk would air. I apologize to those not really interested, but I'm not going to move my commentary around because I have a certain progression in mind. Since coming home, I've spoken with quite a few of you who think we're doing the wrong things, or too few of the right things. That's all good and well, but when asked if they'd like to come home and help out, they're actually starting to give fewer excuses explaining why they can't. Instead, the party is simply being told that these people don't want to come home at all, even though they believe in the Northwest Imperative and could easily obey it. Do I really need to tell the story of the little red hen? All right, no. I'm not going to. But I hope the application is obvious, because I can find better things to fill my time. But who will help us run this party? No, I said I wouldn't. Really, though, this is getting old. We get this all the time from every angle. These people are perfectly happy the rest of us have come home and are trying to perform the heavy lifting required to create a fighting white revolutionary party in the Pacific Northwest. And they're perfectly happy to ask us to entertain them as well as salve their consciences by acknowledging their input. The trouble is, their assistance is required here to pull this off, and they all tend to become irate with the party when one of us suggests they actually migrate, even though not doing so is out of alignment with their stated beliefs. It's one thing for the current set of party associates to stop their lives, come home, and do the work for their sake, but it's quite another for us to ask them to do the same. There's something insulting about this behavior, and this fact definitely goes over the heads of the people who engage in it. But why? Well, it's because another unfortunate aspect of human nature, and especially American white nationalist nature, is we are woefully unaware of ourselves in all the wrong situations. This can take a few different forms, such as overestimating our importance, abilities, or knowledge. It is much more common, at least from the party's standpoint, for this to express itself as a complete and total lack of how best to behave and communicate. For quite some time, I've been trying to find a way to broach this subject politely. Despite some of my detractors and the occasional jokes I make, I'm not actually out to insult other white nationalists. That being the case, I can't help but notice much of the written, well, typed, communication the party receives, be it by email, social media, or message board, is of poor quality. While it's true I'm happy to make allowances for general education deficiencies, especially with non-native English speakers, the problem still stands. Let me give you guys a few pointers. Firstly, sentences start with capital letters and end with punctuation. Don't make us guess where one ends and another begins. Secondly, stream of consciousness isn't appropriate for written communication. Don't assume someone can understand what you're talking about if you type whatever is on your mind without structuring it. An awful lot of our message board posts are nothing but random phrases separated by a form of punctuation called an ellipsis, which is almost always used incorrectly. If you insist on using this sort of punctuation, it has three periods in it, not two or four. And yes, that is a very common and pitiful mistake. Lastly, we can infer a large portion of people don't read books at all, or else I wouldn't need to spend time telling people how to slap a sentence together. If nothing else, please try not to come off as illiterate. My personal experience has shown, with one exception, those who feel entitled to tell the party what to do without coming home themselves write to us in the above manner. Again, I'm not trying to be rude, but it must occur to these folks we can't take them very seriously when they're unable to assemble intelligible communications. It's not like they're well-read enough to discuss political theory or tell the party what we're not doing correctly. I know how that sounds, but if you think about it, it's perfectly reasonable of me to say so. If nothing else, understand your words and behavior send secondary messages to the people you encounter. Make sure they're positive, unlike the ass-sitters who lack the self-awareness to realize how rude they are. They heavily imply that, while agreeing with the Northwest Imperative, they consider their own lives and desires too important to be interfered with while expecting the party and its associates to compensate for their slack. I won't keep you all any longer today, but I must note I will follow up more with what sort of messages your behavior can send next time. I understand this hasn't been the most interesting material, and I apologize for that, but I will refer back to all of it, especially the stages of learning. Laying this base will let me get somewhere in my next discussion, and I appreciate your willingness to bear with me. I promise my next Real Politics submission will be a bit more practical and stimulating. Hail victory, comrades.
Now, last week, I played a kind of lilac medieval piece, allegedly about Robin Hood, from a group calling itself Wild Oats, whom I described as kind of hippy-dippy retreads from the 60s, and they may or may not be that, but their music is kind of like that. Anyway, it got some good responses. There's a lot of what you might call modern medieval music or modernized medieval music, with various modern musicians either trying to reproduce the mellows of the Middle Ages exactly, or else trying to rewrite history and put a left-wing or environmental spin on the songs and the culture of people who would have had no idea what the hell these modern feminists and lefties are talking about, and if they did, they'd probably slit their throats as blasphemers. Anyway, this is one from a group of lilac British women calling themselves Medieval Babes, B-A-E-B-E-S. I don't know what their political inclination is, probably lefty, since their albums get recorded and distributed, and nothing even mildly to the right of center is allowed to see the light of day in Britain these days, but this is not a bad number. It's called Earth Upon Earth, and it sounds like it's sung in Middle English, the English of Chaucer. So far as I can tell, this is actually a real medieval song and not some lilac New Agey imitation, and it sounds pretty good.
Set up. evening, comrades. Tonight I've decided to review a book by Matthias Gardel. This is a book called Gods of the Blood. Now, the reason that I was drawn to this overview is because I was very concerned last week. I was watching, listening to the show, and I was very concerned about this religious problem that I think that some individuals were having. They were choosing the joys of the earth over heroics, and I immediately decided that this was a religious problem. Now, of course, I leaned more towards Dharmic faith, and years ago when I was somewhat looking into the movement, I was at first very drawn to Ozatro and Odinism and that kind of thing. And one of the people that I found on the internet is this Elsa Christensen. She is apparently someone who was a Strasserite, so she was rather decentralized in her view. She was rather involved in this notion of the gods as archetypes within Northern Europeans and maybe whites generally. She felt that the problem with Western society was primarily religious. Now, this book also goes into, because it's an overview, it also goes into Steve McNullen, and it talks about how he's focused primarily on the cultural aspects. And this has been very functional for him. It's been a very good choice because he's been able to do a lot while not getting involved in any controversies. There are different degrees of Odinists, and this is really an introduction, and I almost think it gives, in some respects, too much information. There are all different manifestations of Odinism, but I think one of the more positive, as I've said before, is Yost, who is interested in Kriya Yoga, and he gets very involved with meditation, and he has this very interesting idea of the Kali Yuga. He states that right now, instead of an equatorial Kali Yuga, as Savitri Devi believed, we're actually in a galactic Yuga, which is more subtle. One of the things that you'll find as a theme is this notion of Odinism as an aspect of personal evolution. Now, this book also talks about Lane and the Order and how Lane was interested in Odinism, but for him it was more political. And it also talks about how he was against conservative patriots that like to fly the flag. And one of the things that Lane talked about, he had these two tiers of propaganda and lone wolves and how they would have two totally functions. Now, one of the things that this book gets into, because I think this book, again, gives more information than maybe you'd want, it also gets into this whole aspect of Satanism and the Church of Set. Now, the writer does say that really the Satanists are not, they're not really supporters of the white nationalist cause in any sense. Instead, they're really manipulators, and they're using symbols for their own purpose of creating essentially mayhem within groups. So they're really a very destructive force. And I think that underscores the reason that we really need to do background checks, to really check out who's getting involved, because there are certain signs to look for that this book discusses. Things like a person who is gratuitously cruel or has some background in pornography, those are warning signs, and background checks would help greatly for that. Now, one of the people that renounced these ideas was Miguel Sereno, who, of course, mentioned in the Aradharma book as being someone who's very authentic and whose ideas or concepts can be taken as important. Now, I don't believe in all of his ideas. I think some of his notions are rather out there, but I think his basic view of Hitler as an avatorial figure can be respected. And also McVan of Wotan's Volk has also denounced that type of interpretation or involvement. Now, one of the things that did happen in Sweden, which is a hotbed of Ozatro and also other things, black metal and those type of things, is the Algermanish Hedish Front. And that's a front that deals with things like animal rights and environmentalism, as well as the folkish beliefs, folkish paganism. It does say that the Third Reich was really the first place that you see a green movement. Now, the author of this book does say that National Socialism, as I've said before, is really an ideology that is neither left nor right. It incorporates some aspects of both, and then once you get into some of these Azotro people especially, who get into this sort of Jeffersonian farming and this sort of decentralized and Strasser and views, then you have this whole other polarity. So the author does say that these ideologies are complicated. And he also talks about the various leaders and followers and how it's really more upper middle class than anything else. It's not people that are very poor so much. It's not people who live in trailers. That's really not the case. Although maybe people who have made total life commitment who are very poor, and they're poor because they don't have an opportunity to make a lot of money. They've dedicated themselves to the movement rather than their own personal needs. So, going back to this initial concern, I understand that people have free will, and if a person is more interested in Nookie than they are in the movement, then really that person is not right for this movement, because a person who wants to take on a leadership role, they have to be prepared to give things up, and if you're not, then really you're not ready. You know, I have to say that I'm not surprised that some people would be enticed by the joys of the earth, but I really see a spiritual problem when somebody is so enticed by, what, I don't know, cheap women they can pick up at a bar rather than Valhalla and Valkyries, you know, some cheap woman that you find at some bar or on the dating scene who wants to have a lot of encounters is better than being a hero. I laugh at myself for being so religious. I suppose it's rather, a part of me says I'm foolish to be so religious because, after all, when I think about 1945, I say, well, okay, if there really is an Odin and these gods, or there may be these Nordic aliens that have these spaceships, or whatever they have, I say, where were they in 1945, for example? And it makes me feel rather like an atheist at those moments. But then in other moments, I think about the spiritual problem that exists. And I just think it's so important to have sort of a religious foundation. And I just think that Azotro provides this, or Odinism, whatever you want to call it, whatever manifestation one wants to look at, whether it's ethnic or racial. And those two tactics are slightly different. One is more cultural, one is more political. But I think that it spurs one on to a heroic lifestyle that one might not have if you have no feeling for that. So I just wanted to discuss that vision, that sort of heroic vision of life and relationship to divinity that one might develop. Now, as I said, I'm somewhat disappointed in this book because I think it goes into too many things that feel irrelevant to the movement. But on the other hand, if you're willing to sift through some of this, which can get rather dark, I suppose one can find a lot of varying directions, but I would almost say it's too much for a beginner because it might put you off in the wrong direction. So I hope you enjoyed this review, and I hope that for their own spiritual good that people become more religious, because really, what's so great about these earthly pleasures anyway? In Dharmic faith, for example, if you're going to look at Hinduism, this notion of quote-unquote nookie is something that only evolves according to the Orthodox Hindu conception of time in the Kali Yuga. So it's a very base way of interacting or finding gratification anyway. And I suppose the only way to redeem it is to see it as a mystical union of Krishna and Radha. I mean, that's the only way I can find anything in it. So at any rate, I hope you enjoyed my review, and please consider the state of your soul and not just of momentary ego gratification. So thank you for listening, and hail victory.
Comrades, this is Olivia. I was recently catching up on some past Radio Free Northwest podcasts. In one of them, Harold was talking about what different people go through in the process of becoming racially aware. I don't suppose my story is really all that much different from others, yet in its own way, it's unique to me. I grew up in what most would consider to be a pretty racially homogenous environment here in the Northwest homeland. Oh, sure. There were a few niggers, spicks, and gooks running around on the fringes of the area where I lived, and probably even some wogs, come to think of it. But I don't remember actually seeing anyone who wasn't white until I was about 13 or 14 years old, and then only at a distance. There were a couple of kids of various races that attended my junior high and high schools, but they were so far removed from my world, they had no impact at all. In college, I encountered a bit more diversity, but here again, there just wasn't much of a diverse population in the area where I lived, so it wasn't a whole lot different from high school. Although I did have a couple of personal encounters that weren't particularly pleasant. Eventually, I decided to spread my wings a bit and moved back east. I was pretty young and naive, so I was totally and completely unprepared for what was to come. I ended up getting in trouble fairly soon into my little adventure because of a muttered comment that one of my illustrious coworkers had been promoted only because she was black. It wasn't a comment made with conscious thought. It just slipped out of my mouth before I even realized what I was saying. Apparently, someone overheard me, though, and I got called on the carpet. It's a good thing my boss liked me or I would have been in some serious trouble. But he did caution me that I'd best get my act together and get on board with this diversity thing, or I was going to find myself out of work with a racist reputation. In all honesty, up to that point, I don't really remember having a racist thought in my life. I'd read enough older science and history books to know the races were, in fact, different. Besides, all you had to do was put the races side by side and look at them to understand they were vastly different. However, some of the garbage I was being taught in school did sink in. The few ethnic people I had encountered had acted white, at least in my presence. So I bought into the idea that all anyone needed was the right opportunity, and no matter what your race, you would succeed. Don't get me wrong, I knew race was more than skin deep, but I didn't realize it is fundamentally who we are. That particular snippet of information took me a good 20 years to figure out, although the seeds had been planted. In an effort to avoid getting in more trouble and to prove I wasn't a racist, I started attempting to build friendships with some of the women of other races I worked with, especially blacks, since that's where I'd gotten into trouble. Talk about an almost impossible task. They all had chips the size of Texas on their shoulders, blaming me, since I was white, for all their problems. Needless to say, I only lasted about 4 years before I couldn't handle the atmosphere anymore, although I never admitted to myself that racial issues were the reason I wanted to go back home. Once I was back home in more familiar territory, here in the homeland, race issues slipped to the back burner as I went about my life. But life had more curveballs for me since it seemed I was destined to understand and come to terms with this issue of race. I had about 5 years of relative calm on the racial front when I suddenly found myself confronted with a situation that required me to move to Southern California. Now the race issue wasn't niggers like back east, it was beaners. My oh my, was that an education. They're a whole other kettle of fish. Their chip isn't, you know me, my great-great-grandmother to the 10th power was a slave. No, their issue was, you stole our land. You're a white gringo trash. If you don't watch your back, I'll stab you the first chance I get. Once again, I'd never seen them up close and personal before, with the exception of a few whiteified specimens trotted out to convince Whitey that race is only skin deep. So I was completely shocked at the reality I was living. That was probably the longest year of my life. I was never so glad to get back to the Northwest as I was when I moved out of California. But I didn't get to go back home this time. Economic issues forced me to search for work in the metropolitan areas, and I ended up in the Seattle area instead, which is about as different from where I'd grown up as LA is from Boise, Idaho. It wasn't as bad as the East Coast or California. It was significantly whiter, and I felt significantly safer. But it was full of crunchy granola liberals who cram, "The races are all equal. We're all one big family," down your throat until you want to gag. On top of that, even though the area was significantly whiter, I now had a whole new set of race issues to deal with, because this area is literally crawling with Asians of every kind and color imaginable, at least in my field of work. Once you get out into the suburbs, it's not so bad, but I had to work with them in large numbers day in and day out, which put serious strain on my ability to continue to buy into race being only skin deep. Yeah, right. True understanding was still another 10 years or so away, though. Life went on. I changed jobs 2 or 3 times, moved a couple of times, and even got involved in a really fundamental Judeo-Christian British Israel church for a while. It was in the process of leaving that church that I started finding Christian identity material which talked about how the Jews weren't God's chosen people, but rather were literally the children of the devil. That seemed a bit far-fetched and certainly opposite of what I'd been taught all my life, but something inside me perked up and took notice. So I started reading everything I could get my hands on. Suddenly, something finally clicked. I started looking at the world with new understanding and seeing the reality of what I'd been reading enacted right before my eyes. Niggers are niggers, beaners are beaners, gooks are gooks, and none of them is or can be white. As my understanding grew, I started to realize these were things I'd always intuitively understood and that I'd allowed the world to tell me who to be and what to believe. But it wasn't until I actually read the Northwest novels that I finally comprehended just how much damage is being done to us in this race war, and how vitally important it is for white men and women to stand up and fight for a country of our own where we can once again make dreams come true and soar with the eagles.
I think we need a bit of a musical change of pace here, and so I'm going to play a little item by Sean Davey called Bjorken and Columba. It is about a kind of magical duel that was supposedly fought back in ancient times in the Isle of Man between St. Columba, who was, of course, a good Christian, and a druid named Bjorken, or Bjorken, not quite sure how to pronounce that, and I won't get into a long, involved fairy tale here, but needless to say, in Christian mythology, the Christian won, and I'm sure pagan people have their own ideas. But anyway, this is an interesting little pipe and drum orchestral piece. Now, you know how I'm always ragging on you folks to come home, here to the homeland where you belong, and I'm constantly getting heckled by some of you claiming that I'm not specific enough? Not enough details, I don't spell out everything in words of one syllable and explain to you step by step how to do it? Well, actually, I have pretty much explained that. Now, you know how some Americans have this you're not the boss of me attitude, but others want to be micromanaged so they don't have to take any responsibility for themselves? Well, the Northwest Trucker is out on the road and doing audio files for us on his phone again, and he has some details for you on how you can make your Northwest migration.
He's bound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound, just like old Bandit Run. Keep your foot hard on the pedal, son, never mind them brakes.
Comrades, this is the trucker checking in on the Lincoln Highway from Sydney, Nebraska. And seeing as how I'm on the Lincoln Highway, I'll give you a few tips and stuff on your westward migration to the homeland. Over there in Iowa, at exit 142, just east of Des Moines, there's a Flying J truck stop that's got a motel right next door. It's got plenty of truck parking, so you can go and circle your wagons there and find a nice comfortable bed to lay your head on. And as you come on west, here in Sydney, Nebraska, they've got Walmart with truck parking, and there's parking along the street, and there's a Motel 6 and a Days Inn here. And if you happen to be camping, you can go over there to the Cabela's here in Sydney, and they've got a campground attached to the right next door to their big store. And as you head on westward, over there at Cheyenne, Wyoming, Little America has got truck parking and a motel there. The Flying J, just one exit south on I-25. They've got truck parking at the Flying J truck stop there, and right across the street there's a motel. And over there, just west of Green River, Wyoming, there's another Little America that's got plenty of parking area with their own motel right there on premises. And unless you hear the siren call and need to go down and hit Temple Square, my recommendation is to take the next exit on your westward journey and go US 30 and go through Cokeville on up into Idaho that way, because you got a lot less traffic, a little bit more scenery, and just before you hit I-15 there in Idaho, there's a place called Lava Hot Springs. They've got parking along the curb. Right across the street from the hot springs is a motel where you can go and bed down, and to go and soak your weary bones and stuff, you can go and hit the Lava Hot Springs. And they've got, about 7 or 8 different pools, starting at about 104 degrees on up to about 112 or so, I believe it was. Oh, it's nice. I've stopped there a few times. It's worth the stop. And on your westward journey over there in Twin Falls area, there's another Flying J that has a motel right next door to it. And it's even got animal pens set up there for your horses and stuff, if you need to go and let them stretch their legs and stay outside for the night rather than being cooped up in the trailer. And let's see now. Yeah, I'll go and continue this on at a next episode. You have safe travels. Haven't seen very many U-Hauls or Penske trucks heading west today. Hope to see you in the homeland soon there, comrades. This is the trucker signing off from on the road. Bye now. This is the trucker again, covering the I-90 migration to the homeland. Starting off over there in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, just west of the cities, is a little town called Rogers, Minnesota, exit 207. They've got a TA or truck stop there with a motel right across the street from it, so you'd be able to park your wagon train there and bed down for the night. And as you head westward, getting up into North Dakota and stuff, Castleton, North Dakota, got a truck stop, and right across the street they've got a hotel motel deal right there where you can go and bed down. over in Steele, North Dakota at exit 200. There's a little truck stop there where you can go and circle your wagons, and right across the street there's a motel there also. And anything west of Bismarck is oil country over there through Dickinson and that, so you're going to have a hard time trying to find places to bed down there, so because all the oil workers are taking up most of the lodging over that neck of the woods, so it's kind of scarce till you get over into Montana. And Mile City, Montana, exit 138, there's a pilot truck stop with, I think it's a Motel 6 and another motel right next door to it and stuff, so you can circle your wagons down there. And coming westward out of Billings, you'll get to see the Guardian filling your windshield, the Rockies. Oh, it's such a magnificent sight on a clear day with all the snow up there in the mountains. Nothing better. And as you head on westward there, Rocker, Montana, right there where I-90 meets, there's a Flying J truck stop with a motel next door to that on the north side of the highway. And when you get over to on the west side of Missoula, Meralt's truck stop with a motel right next door to it on the north side of the interstate, and on the south side, the Crossroads, which is now a TA truck stop with motel accompanying it on the same piece of property. And when you get over there to Superior, Montana, there's a just east of it, about exit 50, mile post 57, I believe it is. There's a rest area, and during the summer months, they have a campground open there. I'm not sure how much it is at night there, but if you're in the camping mood and stuff, you can go and be able to swing in there and camp out overnight. And when you get over to Post Falls, Idaho, the Flying J there, right across the street from it, has a motel also. And depending on what part of the homeland you're going to there, comrades, pretty much Ellensburg also, Washington, where the I-90 and I-82 meet. There's a Flying J, and right next to it, there's a motel next door to it also, and they also have a campground there. So, hope to see you soon, comrades. Have safe travels, and hope this helps out. This is the Trucker, signing off.
Eastbound and down, loaded up and trucking. Are we gonna do what they say can't be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm eastbound up, watch old Bandit run.
Quite a difference from the days of the covered wagon, eh? Interstate highways and nice, soft motel beds. Guys, I'm going to take some time out here and tell you a personal story. In May of 2002, when I was coming home myself, I was rolling westward down Interstate 80 in Nebraska, and I stopped for lunch at a truck stop somewhere between Hastings and North Platte, if I recall correctly. And it was one of those big plaza-type truck stops with a motel and a big restaurant and a little shopping mall. I'm sure you've all seen the kind of place I'm talking about. And I bought a local newspaper to read over lunch from Hastings, if I remember right. And I read it while I was eating, and there was a story in that paper about a recent historical find in the area. A local utility crew had been digging an underground cable trench or something of the kind, and they had come upon a grave site with a rough wooden coffin. They called in archaeologists from some Nebraska university to excavate it and identify it. There were some remains in the coffin, presumably skeletal, which they were able to carbon date from around 1850 or so. There were remnants of clothing, what appeared to be a calico and gingham dress. Now, the archaeologists identified the remains as that of a female Caucasian, a teenage girl of about 16 years old. Nothing to identify her beyond that, no way to tell what her name was. Judging from a number of other indicators, they believed that she had been a member of a party of early pioneers who had been crossing the prairie. She died on the way, no way to tell how or why. Her family knocked together a makeshift coffin for her from whatever lumber they had to hand, possibly part of their wagon, and they buried her before moving on their way westward, leaving their daughter behind forever, to be remembered only as a name and Maybe some old faded 19th century glass plate photograph among her descendants, who eventually made it to California or Oregon or Washington, and who no doubt have not the foggiest idea who she was. And when I had read this newspaper story, I looked all around me at the restaurant and the motel and the little stores full of useless plastic junk and the superhighway outside with the cars and the trucks whizzing by at 65 miles an hour on their way west. And for the first time, I think it really hit me what those pioneers had gone through in order to do what so many of you are too timid and frightened to do. These unknown white people, 170 years or so ago, left their home in Pennsylvania or North Carolina or Massachusetts, walking or riding at about 5 miles an hour, most likely to St. Joseph, Missouri, where they spent their life savings on overpriced supplies, and then they just started walking again, walking west. No one waiting for them, no idea where they'd end up, no idea what lay ahead. Just following the ancient call of our race that's been with us for 5,000 years, since the first Aryans started walking west towards the setting sun from our first homeland around Lake Baikal in central Russia. The Celts, the Doric Greeks, the Medes, the Scythians, the Goths, the Franks, the Lombards, the Slavs, the Magyars, the Norse, that's how they all got to where they settled and became nations. They just started heading west. 5,000 years this little stroll of ours has been going on, and now we're too timid and weak to complete the journey and save our people from extinction. Those ancestors of ours set out fully knowing what price they might pay for this new land, and they paid it when they left their daughter or their young wife in that crude box buried beneath the Nebraska sod. But us? Oh no, we can't come northwest. That's too risky. That's too dangerous. We might not be able to get a minimum wage job in Washington flipping burgers beside Mexicans. Oh, horrors! No, no, no. Too chancy. What in God's name have these evil Jews done to us? What have we done to ourselves? The Butler Plan has been in existence since the year 2000. The Northwest novels have been around beginning from 2003. The central idea of Northwest independence has been adequately explained to those in our own community, and the complete lack of any realistic alternative plan, or indeed any plan at all, is now crystal clear. So what the hell is everybody waiting for? Basically, they're still waiting for Harold Covington to wave his magic wand, pull the magic beans out of his pockets, and make it all just happen. They're still watching and waiting for Harold to do it all and produce a finished product that they don't have to help build. They are waiting for Harold and the small handful of people I have here in the homeland to get all the heavy lifting done. They're waiting for the cakes and ale to be set out. Now let's be blunt, they are waiting to be given things. Oh sure, when the word gets out that there is some place that white nationalists can go and meet actual, real people, and not email addresses, then we'll have a flood of newcomers, once the dam breaks and they see someone else going first. We just can't find that small handful of people we need who are willing to go first. Now I'm not referring to the young men with nothing but the t-shirts on their backs. They're a special case. I've discussed them before, and I'll discuss them again. But the fact is that we don't have a bunkhouse or a refrigerator full of beer to offer them, and they're not really part of the equation. I get complaints to the effect of, "Oh, Harold, I can't come northwest now. There's no safety net." Well, you're right. The lack of a safety net didn't bother our pioneer ancestors who loaded up their Conestoga wagons. And before that, it didn't bother the immigrants who crowded into the holds of those ships headed for Ellis Island. And before that, the immigrants who crowded into the holds of the wooden sailing vessels that headed for Jamestown and Plymouth Rock. But these are 21st century white people, and they're not made of the old stuff, the right stuff. 21st century whites are products of Anheuser-Busch, the Frito-Lay Corporation, and Mickey D's. No, what we need are substantial white people who have displayed some energy, some talent, some work ethic, and who have achieved some personal success in life. We need you to come here, to bring your skills and your talents and your assets with you and help us build that very safety net, so that when this whole American ball of wax comes unglued And we have thousands of white people showing up here in the homeland as genuine, honest-to-God refugees, like the Horakova family and Freedom Sons, then there will be some way for us to take them in and get them incorporated into the party, into Northwest society, and into the revolution. Now, it's been said that if someone is a success already in Florida or Ohio or Texas or Wisconsin, then they're not going to come to the Northwest because they don't need to. This assumes that these are just typical Americans who do nothing unless it's for economic motives or out of self-interest. I agree there's a lot of people like that, probably the majority of our people, but that's not the kind of migrants we need here in the homeland. We are not asking people to migrate because there's something in it for them, although in point of fact there is quite a bit in it for them personally. We're asking them to come home to the land that God and or destiny has appointed to be our people's lifeboat in the storm. We're asking that because it is right. Let's consider this a test of character. We need people with that old pioneer spirit who do not come expecting to be given things on their arrival. The American sense of entitlement stops here. We will either recover that old pioneer spirit or else we'll perish from the face of the earth. So just let me tell you this. If and when you finally do screw your courage to the sticking point, as Shakespeare said, and you're on your way out here to your future homeland down Interstate 80 or maybe Interstate 90 if you take a more northerly route, look out your car or your truck window at that barren landscape around you as you're going through Nebraska or Colorado or Wyoming, and think about how many other graves like that young girl's are out there, undiscovered and unnamed, along the way that you're now traveling at 65 miles an hour, headed for a soft bed in a motel. And when it finally hits you, all of a sudden, whether or not you can get a job in Seattle or Boise or some town in Oregon won't seem quite so earth-shaking a consideration now, will it? Now, when I read that newspaper article back in 2002, I was struck by the eerie similarity between what I was reading and a song that I remembered from my childhood during the great folk music craze of the 60s. This is the Kingston Trio. This has gone an hour and 4 minutes already. Damn, I'm running long. Well, time flies when you're having fun. I did kind of have to get Gretchen on this week since I cut her last week, though. Okay, I have something that's actually pretty important I wanted to wind up with. I'm running out of minutes here, but let's give it a shot, and hopefully the lack of time will keep me from going off on any Grandpa Simpson tirades. I wanted to talk to you folks about a guy named Ibrahim Tertashev, a Chechen Muslim who up until May of this year was living in Orlando, Florida with his wife. I say was because on May the 22nd, Mr. Tertashev got a visit from 3 or possibly 4 FBI agents and 2 hoodlums from the Massachusetts State Police. He was held prisoner in his apartment for something like 8 hours, during which time he was subjected to what the media variously described as quote-unquote grueling interrogation or intensive questioning, for which read torture. Now that's the first thing that reeks about this case. They claimed that they were asking him about a triple homicide in Massachusetts, which is horseshit, because as any police academy cadet knows, when you are dealing with a potentially violent suspect, the first order of business is to secure control of the individual and the environment so he can't get at any weapons or harm the officers. I.e., you handcuff his ass, and you take him to the station, and you sit his ass down in an interview room and turn on a video camera recorder. You do not sit in his apartment for 8 hours with him and deny him the right to leave or the right to see an attorney, which is what happened here. But bear in mind, we are now living in Obama's America. Apparently, what the FBI was really interested in questioning him about was something to do with Tamerlan Tchernayev, who was allegedly one of the Boston Baked bombers, the one who got killed. Now, needless to say, the Bureau refuses to reveal the exact nature of their questions or anything that was said during the 8 hours, and apparently no recorded record was kept, and Tertashev did not write down a single word, a confession, nothing, during the entire 8 hours, or at least if he did, it hasn't been produced. Then around midnight, Tertashev either pissed the FBI off because he wouldn't tell them what they wanted to hear, or else he did tell them what they wanted to hear, and they decided they didn't want him telling anybody else. And they fired 7 bullets into his body, 6 from the front and 1 in the back of his head to finish him off. Now, under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011, the President of the United States and other so-called competent federal authority is now legally entitled to order the murder of United States citizens without charge or trial. I am not sure from the media coverage whether Ibrahim Tertashev was a United States citizen or not, but it didn't seem to matter. So far as is admitted by the media, this has only been done on foreign soil so far. But it's common knowledge that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been carrying out extrajudicial executions for some time. This appears to be one of them. The FBI claimed that around midnight, Tertashev went insane and attacked them with either a knife, or a metal pole, or a broomstick, or a samurai sword, depending on whose statement you read. And so they just had to fire 6 bullets into his torso and 1 more into the back of his head to defend themselves, of course. And then either ravens, or flying monkeys, or leprechauns came in and made off with the knife or broom handle or whatever, because no weapon was ever found on the scene. Jesus, if you bastards are going to murder people, I wish you'd just do it and don't insult our intelligence. You were too damn lazy to even plant a weapon of some kind on the poor dumb wretch. Why bother, guys? I mean, really. Why not just knock on people's doors and gun them down on the doorstep, and then you and your partner can drive your black government SUV with the illegal tinted windows to Applebee's for lunch? It's not as if anybody's going to raise a hand to stop you. Now, we all know that you are totally unaccountable as long as you can get an assistant U.S. attorney or other quote-unquote competent federal authority to sign off on it. Nothing is going to be done about it. And if any local authorities ever tried, you've got the Military Tribunals Act of 2006 to immunize you legally, as long as you can claim that you fired the bullets into the body in good faith, however that might be defined in your bloody, murderous little world. Nothing was done about it this time, either. Obama's little death squad were all cleared of all charges a couple of days ago. Since 1993, when the Clintons came into power, the FBI has cleared its own agents in every single shooting they've been involved in. 70 fatalities, and 80 woundings. Apparently, our friends in the silk suits, in addition to being cowardly murderers, aren't very good shots. But our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.